Thank you. Yeah, we're going to touch on probably the favorite memory verse of non-Christians, right? It's the one verse that everyone who's not a Christian knows. What is it? Don't judge, right? Don't you judge me. It's like, where'd you get that from? Well, from Jesus, which is ironic that if you want to share how Jesus has authority and wisdom for life, that someone turns to the authority of Jesus to keep you from going forward in that. And it sort of reminds me of a time when I was in college and I saw a guy with a sandwich board walking up and down the place where everyone debates things and whatnot. And he had on there a scripture verse a little bit different. It was Genesis 1:29, what I'd never seen paraded publicly. Does anybody know what it is? God created every seed-bearing plant and herb. And that was his sandwich sign. He's walking back and forth, and he has this picture of a big marijuana leaf on it. And he's just really excited. So, yeah, so I came up to him, and I'm like, wow, that's really cool that you're using scripture and stuff. Are there any other verses you know? He's like, no, man, it's about the weed. I'm like, really? In the same way, when people tell us, don't you judge, and they're quoting Jesus, it's not because they want to recalibrate your understanding of how to listen to and obey Jesus. They just don't want to go there. So what do you do? And what we're going to go through this today is not to win a debate on the right exposition of how to judge so that you can then lecture them on how to read the Sermon on the Mount, particularly Matthew 7, but for ourselves to take Jesus' wisdom and how, if we read that whole passage together, he actually gives us some very healthy, sensible advice that helps us to achieve three things that we want to do. We want to be faithful to the Great Commission and to share our faith with other people. We want to be friendly and get along with our coworkers and not cause problems and hassles unnecessarily. And we want to be effective. When we share our message, we want what we say and what they hear to be as close as possible instead of just trying to share with somebody so I can then go tell my Christian friends I did it. I sent him a message, and so please be proud of me, right? And so those are the things that we're looking for, and we're going to try to put it in a slightly business tone here because I think in business there's a lot of sensibilities. All right, three things I'm going to ask you to do as we go through this, and the first one is when someone says, don't you judge, agree with them. Jesus said it, your whole message is about Jesus, so agreeing not to judge doesn't put you at a disadvantage at all. And so agree that neither you nor they are the judge or the other. Who is the judge or the other? Reality. Now, Dallas Willard says reality is what you run into when you're wrong, right? And so the idea of thinking that this is a door and pushing into it and running into it, whatever is true, regardless of whether I want it to be or true or not. And so when we have a diverse environment and people are sharing their views of reality, the one thing that we can agree on is whatever is real is real. And if I'm wrong, that matters. And then the discussion about how we perceive different things is, well, how do you perceive reality? How do you do it? And that makes it to where neither I'm not the judge, they're not the judge, reality is the judge, and we're working towards that reality ourselves. So in that, let's just read what Jesus says in Matthew 7, verse 1. This is after a sequence of advice that he's been giving on various things. He says, do not judge so that you will not be judged. For with the judgment you use, you will be judged, and with the measure you use it, you will be measured to you. This is in the same line of reasoning that he does with giving money, with praying, with fasting. He says, when you give money, there is a question that you may have is, what's your motive? Is it to be seen giving money? And so you have your compassion child on your cubicle, you know, put up there so it's really clear that everybody knows that you've been given money to care. He says, if you really want to make sure that your motive isn't sociological in your religious stuff, do it to where nobody knows. There's no cash-in value to this. He says the same thing about prayer. There's no prohibition against praying in public, but he says, if you want to know how much you really care about prayer, do it in private, and you'll be able to see whether it's only for the sociological impact of praying in public or whether you're really communicating with God. Same thing with fasting, and here with judging, it's not forbidding it. It's telling you that taking a judgmental position in trying to fix other people is really going to lead you into problems. The problem here is this. Foolishness is pitting values against one another. For example, the idea of in business, which one is more important, profit or customer service? It's a terrible question, isn't it? And so the idea is that, do you value profit? Yes, as a business you do. And the aspect of customer service, though it has more than just a subset of being part of profit, it is something that's connected. The goal is to connect these values in complementary ways. For example, how many of you, when you get French fries, really struggle with whether you should hand them back in to get some that are really hot? Is there anybody in here that does that? My wife is that way, and to be a gentleman, I feel like I have to do it, and I hate doing it. I just feel so squeamish about it, but she's like, I don't want to eat fries normally, and so if I go into a place and we're going to have fries, and I'm going to actually give in and get all the calories from fries, I want the fries to be hot and taste right, okay? So the business has a value of making a profit, and I just bought the fries, and I come back and say, these fries aren't hot enough. As the manager, what would you do? Would you get a thermometer and stick it in there and debate? I'll be the judge of whether they're hot or not. Instead, what would you do? Oh, yeah, customer service. You're like, here, let me take those. And here's some other fries. And then you see one of your workers then just start handing out free fries. You're going to say, no. It's not about handing out free fries. It's about integrating various values. So it's not compromise of your profit motive, but it's also not being so rigid in your profit motive that you undermine it, that no one wants to go back to your store because they find it combative, argumentative, and difficult, even if the thermometer says that the fries were in the range of hot enough, right? And so our goal then is, in the same way that we want to integrate these concepts of sharing our faith with other people, this idea of bringing together the faithfulness to do what God has called us to do, the friendliness of meaningfully interacting with other people as people, and even the effectiveness that as we do this, it makes a difference, is what we should be aiming for. In 1 Peter 3:15, Peter is talking to people that are afraid as a minority group to share their faith in Christ, belief that there will be consequences from it. And he holds that tension together for them. So if you want to look up briefly, 1 Peter 3:15, I'll read it to us. In 14, he tells them about don't be afraid, but in verse 15, in your hearts, revere Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who does what? Who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect. This gives you a clear conscience so that if someone then accuses you maliciously, the quality, the goodness, the genuineness, the sincerity, the sensibility of how you do this gives you no cause to be ashamed or afraid. This is a biblical example of how one should be in their attitude and posturing when sharing your faith. This isn't a compromise to where the value is fear God, not man, and so be bold, and that's where we sometimes feel that to be a true evangelist, I don't care about what people feel. Well, this isn't that type of compromise that says I'm just worried about other people's feelings and want to be liked. This is wisdom. What's an example of that would be in Acts 17. Acts 17 is where Paul goes into a metropolis, and there in Athens he has intellectually informed people from different cultures, well-traveled people with very diverse views. And that's like all of us as we work here in the most diverse city in the United States, Houston, that we have people that we really enjoy and like and work with that come from all sorts of different backgrounds of atheistic or Hindu or Muslim or Buddhist or various forms of Christian-related groups. And we want to interact, but we need to find a way to do it with gentleness and respect, but still in a way that says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. How do we do that? When Paul does it, he's able to talk in a way that he understands the people that he's talking to. He says, I see that you're very religious and you have these different ways that you worship. And in this, I see that there's a question within your own belief system that I would like to speak to. He speaks respectfully, but he then differentiates his own position, and he says that we know that Jesus, through being raised from the dead, is the point that changes our view of reality. Once he gets to that point, some people say, I don't want to hear it anymore. Others say, this is interesting. Could you give me more detail? Has he been faithful? He has. And the fact that some shut him down and they don't want to hear the details of the life, death, resurrection of Christ doesn't mean that he hasn't been faithful. It just means that he has filtered through who's a receptive audience, and he's poured his energy into that receptive audience so that when he leaves, they will still have bridge contact with the other people. That's being wise. That's integrating those responsibilities of connecting both to God and to people in the message in one way. All right. So how do we then go forward in doing this with some degree of practical effectiveness? Part of what happens then is, I would say, once we have this attitude that I'm not being compromised, I actively want to ask questions to understand the other person. That's part of what's going on here when Jesus takes us forward in verses 3 through 6. So back in Matthew 7, Jesus raises the question in verse 3, what's going on here when you try to fix other people? And he asks the question, why do you look at the wind in your brother's eye, or look at the speck in your brother's eye, but you don't notice the log in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, and look, there's a log in yours, you hypocrite. First, take out the log of your own eye, and then you will see clearly how to take out the speck in your brother's eye. Don't give what is holy to dogs, or toss your pearls before pigs. They'll trample you with them, with their feet, turn and tear you to pieces. And we have all sorts of questions that come up about pigs and dogs, and, you know, is that okay for Jesus to talk like that? And we'll find that he's actually being very, very sensible in what he's saying. So this first aspect then, when he says, why is fixing other people your priority? This, again, is understanding your when. What is it that you would want someone to receive as the message of the gospel? The gospel is that we have been separated from God, and subsequently our ability to connect rightly with others has also been messed up, and ultimately our ability to live, the wages of sin towards God and towards other, is death and separation and brokenness. It's the gospel of reconciliation. It's a relational gospel. If your win is to be reconciled towards God in relationship and towards others in relationship, is it appropriate or inappropriate to be relational and friendly as you're sharing this message? And that's the part that he's making here. Why would you be so obsessed about trying to fix somebody? It's not about fixing someone and posturing yourself. It's about wanting to have things work in a healthy relational way. So, for example, how many of you, if you were going to be hosting a party, maybe would turn to other friends for advice about how to do it well? Or if you're going to go on a business trip and you're really not a golfer, but you got to golf, would turn to a friend and say, hey, can you help me? Give me some basics on golf so I know how to do this. All right? That's okay. But what if you're hosting a party and part of your guests that show up tell you, you know, this is probably how you should have done these napkins. You know, this fork might be over here better. Or you start to play golf and someone says, you know, you really should remember to keep your eye on the ball. What happens then? How does your attitude shift? The difference is not about the content. The difference about it is the relationship that's going on. And if your win is to use the gospel to be able to belittle someone else, to take a position of power and authority over them, that's why people push back. And so by holding back from that and saying, that's not my win, relationship is. He says, if that is your goal, then the first step you're going to need is clarity. And that by taking the log out of your own eye, your ability to have some degree of precision to talk in a helpful way goes up. This is like the idea when you're on a plane and they tell you that if the airbags drop down and you got a kid next to you, what do you do? Block that kid out of the way, grab that mask for yourself. And the first time anyone hears that, no one listens anymore, right? Because everybody's traveled too much. But do you remember the first time you ever saw that display and an adult with a kid and you're supposed to like be selfish and grab the mask for yourself first? It's like so far back, like, I can't even remember my first reaction to it. But it seems extremely counterintuitive, doesn't it? Selfish. What's the reasoning behind it? Yeah, if you're fumbling with the kid's mask and you don't have oxygen and you pass out, then you and the kid are gone. So you put it on yourself so that you stabilize your ability to help the kid in a meaningful way. And it's not a selfishness. that sense of just being sensible is what carries us forward. And so he tells us that in the same way, we should be thinking through how it is that we're going to interact. That idea of the dogs and the pigs, does a dog need a Bible given to them? Does the pig say, here's something holy, here's something beautiful with pearls? No, they want food and they'll get frustrated. The point is trying to give something to someone that's what they don't want. It's not about who's the pig, who's the dog. The point is a mismatch between what you're offering and the people that are receiving it. And so we need to think through that, and we need to think that for ourselves first, but then just like the party or the golf illustration, we then need to think through, do people really need me to be in a posture of fixing? Instead, what we need to have is an idea of actually understanding people. I think I got ahead of myself there. That would be the illustration about who are you to say that. And that's in relationship. When he then goes on here, we typically would say, as we read verses 1 through 6, don't judge lest you be judged. Instead, you take this out, and then you can fix the other people, and don't push stuff on people they don't want, and we're done. But what follows next actually becomes really insightful. If the goal is not judging, but actually bringing something in, what would be a technique that would help? And the answer is asking genuine questions to understand the other person. Not rhetorical setup questions, but real pursuing to understand what people are about. I've had this as something that I've done both in this country and overseas. I was not a Christian growing up, and I had a lot of issues with religious people. The message didn't make sense to me, and a variety of things. When I became a believer after being a Marine, a variety of things helped with that. I became fascinated in all religions and why different people held to different things. And in the 19th century in the United States, there were a lot of Christian cults, basically, break-off groups where people started their own version of Christianity. And it was kind of exciting for me at times to have different evangelists that knock on the door or that have an advertisement. You order their special book and their missionaries come to the door. And it was kind of fun for me to try and learn how things went. It's a weird hobby. And I took different positions. One was to be like a fake seeker, like I'm trying to draw them out, like I'm interested in joining what they're doing, but I'm really not. The other was to be argumentative and to bring them in. And I know their religion, I know their history, I know how it's a cult and what's wrong, and I'm ready for a big debate. But I found that none of that really worked. And there's a principle that relates to that that also relates in business in terms of mutual understanding. What I replaced it with was actually asking them instead of telling them, what do you believe and why? And doing it until I could repeat it back to them. And more than one occasion, I had people from these different groups who were specialists at trying to go door to door and win people that were shocked when I said, so you're saying this is your good news, this is your gospel. And you could tell they were so relieved after all these visits of having the door slammed, they were this close to getting a convert. And they're like, finally, because their belief was the reason no one accepts my message is because they don't really understand it. And if they understood it, they would accept it. And for me to repeat back respectfully and fairly, this is what you're saying, right? And they say, yes. Well, here's why I don't hold to it. Totally changed the game. And suddenly it was about the ideas instead of a power struggle. Another example, I later became a missionary myself and I was in remote China on the Burma border and lived there for a long time. And in this process, I was trekking in this one area and I came across a village that had not seen foreigners since the Flying Tigers, which were right before World War II. And so it was a big deal for them to see this strange guy walking through the village. They invite me in and there's something going on there in the village. And I say, is it a festival? They say, oh no, it's a funeral. And I feel really bad, I'm like, I should go. Like, no, our funerals last 3 days. This is the second day. We have them all the time. Don't worry about it. Come on in. And he was really old, lived a good life. It's fine. We're just hanging out. So, okay. So I come in and meet everybody, and they find it sort of interesting, a Mandarin-speaking foreign guy in this remote village. And they take me into the temple, and all the Buddhist temple elders are there. And I'm thinking, here I am wanting to share Christ, but I'm at a Buddhist funeral. What do I do? What would you guys do? you got the tension of your commission to be faithful, and then you got this idea of being friendly because these really, really nice people have included me. Which principle should take precedence? The idea is they don't. They can be integrated. What I did is I asked genuine, sincere questions, and I listened for their answers. What is this? Who built it? How does that work? When do you do this? What's the next thing you do in the funeral? How does that help? What's this painting mean? Is it related to that or not? Essentially, I turned into a four-year-old kid. And as I turned into this four-year-old kid who's asking these questions, how do you think that makes them feel? Respected, that I'm interested in them, that I'm actually teachable and I'm learning as I'm going through this. And as I ask these questions, they become harder and harder for them to answer. And they say, you know, I don't know. I'm really not sure about that. And finally, one of them gets clever. Instead of always answering these questions, they say, we need to change the subject. What about you? How do you deal with that problem? I'm glad you asked. And then I'm able to explain to them, I understand that when you do this, you're trying to solve the problem of desire. You're trying to solve the problem of suffering. For myself, I believe that God created us, that we're all trying to figure things out, but we've been separated from him. And then ultimately in Jesus, we see how life ought to be lived. But the wrong of the world fights against him. And we see his good, our bad, and his death. And here's the question. Which is greater, his good or our bad? And they all lean forward. They said, well, tell us. The good news is he came back from the dead, not as an angry zombie ghost, which is part of their belief system that they kind of get scared if they don't hear the full story. But he came back healthy and well, and he ate with his friends, and he said, life is greater than death. His good is greater than our bad. And even though there may be a funeral, we have hope that it's not the last time we'll see each other, but we'll be together. And they said, oh, this is wonderful. Would you come back and tell us more? The Chinese village in remote borderland area has its own tensions. Here in a place like this, when you have laws regarding what you can and cannot say in the workplace, and we've got a profit, and we don't want you, profit motive, and we don't want you causing disruption here in the business, they both have tension. And so for all of us, juggling this is not about choosing one value over the other. It's trusting Jesus in his wisdom to go forward with that. And so when he says, don't judge, think about it. You need clarity, and don't force stuff on people that they don't want. Instead, what you should be doing is this. And you'll see the text there on the back, verse 7. Instead, keep asking, and it'll be given to you. Keep searching, and you will find. Keep knocking, and the door will be open to you. Actively seek understanding the other person. This wasn't invented by Stephen Covey. Seek first to understand and then to be understood. That was part of his research of wisdom throughout the years. And Jesus is saying that's the process we should do. And for everyone who asks, receives, and the one who searches, finds. And to the one who knocks, the door will be open. You really can learn things about other people when your questions are non-rhetorical. They're not traps. They're not setups. You really want to know and understand them. And he says, what man among you, if the son asks for bread, will you give him a stone? If he asks for a fish, will you give him a snake? If you then, who are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more your Father in heaven good things to those who ask him? This relationship that you're inviting people into, you should be exhibiting. When I interacted with these cult missionaries and I asked them genuine questions, did they give me genuine answers? Yes. Did these people in the Buddhist temple, when I asked them for how do you deal with life and I treated them as people, did they give me honest answers instead of debate? The answer is yes. And Jesus' wisdom here of ask, seek, knock, pursue, what you're doing is making requests. As a person to another person, will you connect with me on this information, how to go forward? How does he sum this up in verse 12? He says, I would teach you the entire Old Testament if I had time, but this is close enough. The law, the Torah, the Pentateuch, the first five books, and the prophets, which is the articulation of the nuances of the implications of the law of the Torah. He says the whole complicated big Old Testament is basically about learning how personhood works in relating to other people. Relating to God first, And out of the God who made you a person, because God is a person, you have the wisdom and capacity to relate to other people. Do unto others as you would want them to do unto you is the reality by which you relate to others, so that you can tell them the reality that judges us all. And so that's my process that I picked up from Jesus that I think is pretty good. What I want to end up with is this. That last sentence on there. In each of these we go through and we see that we've got the different values put together. That last part. The good news invites people into the most important relationship. Being relational when you share it is effective, it's friendly, and it's faithful. So when you're told, don't judge, get excited. It's a great opportunity to take Jesus' wisdom and authority and to make it a way to connect with people to share that as well. Thanks for hearing me work through this idea with you. And when it's over, I'll be happy to talk more about these ideas. Thank you.